Good afternoon, dear colleagues. If you are listening to this live, then you know that today is the 7th of February, 2024. It's my big pleasure to introduce Professor Dr. Georg Dorfner to you. Professor Dorfner is a professor at the Medical University of Vienna. By background, he's a computer scientist. He holds a PhD and a habilitation in computer science. And has been working in a very interesting department. This department is a department or an institute for artificial intelligence at the Medical University of Vienna. The context of this presentation today is that Professor Dorfner gave a very similar presentation at a symposium that we organized at the Juridicum some weeks ago. Together with Professor Zielinski, and he was one of the highlights during this this event, and that's the reason why I kindly asked him to do this once again now for a broader audience. And Professor Dorfner was so kind to accept this invitation. Professor Dorfner, thank you very much for being here. Perhaps you would like to share with us a very brief introduction about what your department is and how one can end up as a computer scientist at the Medical University of Vienna.
Okay, well, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah, I work for the Institute of Artificial Intelligence at the Medical University of Vienna, and it has a long historic tradition. I've, as a computer scientist, joined in the mid-80s, and back then it was an institute. It was called Institute for Artificial Intelligence and Medical Cybernetics and Artificial Intelligence, founded by Professor Robert Trappel. And it was always part of the medical school. And when they split off into separate university, it stayed with the medical university. And today it's one of seven institutes of the Center of Medical Data Science that on one hand does basic research in computer science, including AI. The head today is Christopher Bock. And on the other hand, has a kind of support function to clinicians and other people at the medical university who have data and are interested in working in AI or machine learning.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and is this a success model in your view, that people who have a computer science background are integrated into a medical university? Or would you, I mean, because I'm asking because when it comes to law schools, mm-hmm. this mm-hmm. was quite common somewhere in the 80s, I would say, that that there was an idea to integrate other disciplines into the law school, which has become much less common since then. And I'm just wondering how this is when it comes to medicine.
Well, I would consider this, yes, definitely as a success story, not just recently when AI has become very, very popular. Also before, I mean, for many years, we have had a master program at the Medical University in medical informatics. And I happen to be the curriculum director for that master program. So, and also our rectorate is very much behind that to position medical informatics to have an important role in the increasing digitalization of medicine. And AI is just one important aspect of it. So I think it makes more than just sense to have mm-hmm. computer scientists at a medical university.
Yeah, and I mean, working for a department that had its in its title artificial intelligence, I don't know, 30 years ago or something, and living living through 2024 must be some kind of specific roller coaster experience, I would say, or triumph, or both. I don't know. How do you perceive this?
It has been in a sense. I remember when we started in the 80s. I mean, many people kind of smiled or laughed at us and say, oh, artificial intelligence, interesting, what is that? Then yeah. It became more established. I started in the second half of the 1980s, and I had learned about neural networks in the United States when I did my PhD mm-hmm. there. And so I brought them with me, so to speak. And my first research I did wasn't considered an AI. I could not publish at artificial intelligence conferences. Mm-hmm. Specialized conferences like NIPS, which is today's NeurIPS, one of the biggest mm-hmm. AI conferences, but it was considered separate. And in a sense, it is a kind of a little bit of a triumph in to say that those people who believed in the power of neural networks and machine learning early on see now how far we have gotten as compared to the more structured, logic-based, semantic type of AI, mm-hmm. not saying that they have not also made important contributions to AI, but most of the recent successes have been in the field of neural networks. And it's kind of, it's at least say interesting to observe how the field I started with is now having a very important role.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting is always a very nice word. So let's perhaps go a little bit more into detail while listening to your presentation that you gave about AI in scientific publications, increase in efficiency or plagiarism 2.0, which is, by the way, also a very, very important topic to every single discipline now. So this is not only relevant for medical students, what we are going to listen here. It's also very important for everyone else, in particular law students. So may I ask you, please, go ahead.
Okay.
I hope that this works technically. Yeah, that looks good. Okay, you have the floor, please.
Okay, thank you very much. So in this presentation, I was asked to say, make a few remarks and highlight a little bit of the role of AI in scientific publications. And as you just said, it's important practically for every field, but I will come to mention a few specific aspects about medical research as opposed to others. But most of the things I'm saying are indeed relevant for other fields as well. So I chose the little provocative title, is it AI in publications increase of efficiency, or is this a new version of plagiarism that we all have to face and fight, perhaps? Just want to say, I mean, at the Institute I already mentioned, I owe a few thanks to colleagues in the lab of Matthias Sambald, who is here at the Institute, actually also doing research with large language models. They helped me in finding an interpretation for some of the things. Yeah, let me start by setting the scene of what we're talking about here. When we talk about AI in publications, we most certainly talk about generative AI. Not so much about AI for diagnostic support, which plays an important role in medicine as well, but the generative AI models, foremost the large language models like ChatGPT that we all know or have heard of, that create output, and that output is something that increasingly is being used or can be used in creating publications, including master thesis, PhD thesis, and so on. So I would like to briefly talk about what's behind that. I already mentioned neural networks, the machine learning method is behind it. The specific model behind large language models is the so-called transformer model, which is a special type of neural network that is able to focus on certain parts of the input, or it's learning to focus which part of the input is important. But basically, in a nutshell, what it does, it takes a text and takes a context, a part of that text, like a long sentence or a paragraph. Actually, it's up to over 1,000 tokens, such as the context that is considered here, and takes this context and tries to predict the next word. So if I take a little snippet of text, computational sleep scoring for multiple neurophysiological time series, it takes this part that's in the box here and tries to predict what is the next word, in this case, time series. And then it shifts the context, shifts to the next word, and again, tries to predict. And from having learned to predict words, it can then be applied generatively, so to generate text. So you can start with a so-called prompt, like another text snippet, like multimodal sleep scoring has, and then it provides predictions, not just one, actually several, attached with certain probabilities, and according to those probabilities, it will choose one of them. So if you start with this prompt, it will have these three alternatives as an example. We'll choose, for instance, the word bin, and then uses the next, the enlarged snippet, multimodal sleep scoring has bin, as a new input, and again, predicts the next output, and for instance, chooses here then the word successful, multimodal sleep scoring has been successful. Actually, even though the model behind it and also the number of degrees of freedom is very, very complex, but in a nutshell, as I said, it doesn't do in first approximation much more than taking text and predicting. And it's generating word by word, as I have highlighted it down here. That's a very important observation for many of the things I will say later. Large language models are not the only type of generative AI. Many of us also know AI programs that generate images like DALL-E or Midjourney. principle is rather similar in a sense. So what the transformer does in the large language model is map the input to a so-called embedding, which is a large number of numbers that code the text context. And instead of using it to predict words, as I just exemplified, such embeddings can also be used to output, generate images. And if you use a prompt like a transformer predicting the next word in the sentence, it will generate a complex image like that. Or another example I used here is a student highlighting the importance of academic integrity, and it delivers a nice image. Many of you probably have seen many examples nowadays. It's very fashionable to use generated images in talks, in presentations. But here, if you allow me a personal comment, I think with respect to publications, they are not quite as useful yet as large language models. Just take this example here on top. I asked it to create something about transformers. Of course, I meant the transformers that are behind the neural networks, but it interpreted transformer being this robot type of creature. So and you don't have really much influence on the specific details, like there might be errors in here and so on. But developments are very fast. I'm pretty sure in a year or two, there will be image generators that are much more powerful. But for the moment, I would like to focus here on the large language models. And here, of course, on the one that we all know best, ChatGPT. Here, as I said, coming back to what it is as a large language model, basically a text-based learner. It's extremely complex. It has actually billions of parameters or weights in the so-called weights of the neural network. And it was also trained on really huge training sets that contained billions of words. And it was language of different text of different languages. It was code from programming languages and so on. And even though it was purely trained on language and it does not have any meaning, so it cannot learn any meaning attached to the text. So if, like an example before, it talks about sleep, it has no idea what sleep really is. It does not have, as we used to say it in the 1980s in cognitive science, not any sensory grounding. ChatGPT as a system cannot experience the world the way we humans experience the world, and therefore it cannot attach any sensory or physical experience-based meanings to it. It's just basically a very large and complex text imitator. It sort of has learned to produce text from sequences of words that to an outside observer make sense without even know the true meaning behind it. And we have to keep that in mind when we use ChatGPT as a language model. Still, and that's the surprising thing, that's what surprised all of us, including the hardcore researchers in this area, is that despite this apparently limited capability, just creating text, it seemingly is able to lead a dialogue, to deduce knowledge, to extract, to present knowledge, to even present diagnosis and things like that. So that was the amazing quality of behavior that came out that surprised everybody and that contributed to this big success and this big move forward in AI ever since ChatGPT was published. Another thing is important to notice when you use actually ChatGPT that the training procedure that I talked before was just one component of it. ChatGPT was then retrained afterwards on, as I call it, political correctness. So it was trained to avoid outputs which are considered not correct. So the famous example, we don't want ChatGPT to give anybody the instructions of how to build a bomb or of how to kill yourself or things like that. So there is a filter built in that would prevent such ethically critical outputs. And therefore that was done afterwards in addition to the original learning. When I said it doesn't have grounding or meaning, I also have to mention, as I mentioned it already, the developments are very fast, and we are already at the edge of beginning to see large language models as actually large multimodal models. So images, as I said, can be created in programs like DALL-E, and text in the large language models are more and more being combined with each other,
We saw examples also in the presentation by Professor Kittler a couple of weeks ago that ChatGPT already today is able to also take images as input and then describe. And in medicine, this leads to already amazing types of outputs. Like if you use this X-ray here of human knees and you ask it, what can you see on this picture? Then it doesn't only describe that those are human knees, but also starts making a kind of diagnosis. In this case, it says it seems to be a normal knee. There's no arthrosis or anything visible. I haven't even asked it for a diagnosis, but apparently it seems ready to be acting like a doctor, saying output more than I actually originally prompted it for. But we have to keep in mind that pretty soon, the more multimodality, so not just images, but also sound and other modalities, will again get the system even closer to what I said it was still missing, namely that grounding, that physical experience that stands behind the text. And therefore, I think even though LLMs are just language-based today, pretty soon they will be even getting much closer to what is called artificial general intelligence. So having the real true intelligence that we humans have, still to go, but it's really amazing how fast we're developing in that direction. But let's go back, and as I said, I would like to say a few things about what we can say today about the use of models like ChatGPT in creating publications, including master thesis and PhD thesis. What is ChatGPT capable of currently? I mean, I have to say, with respect to language, it's nearly perfect. And that's another, coming back to the question that Professor Froebel asked me just before, it's another interesting experience looking back. I started actually my career with a high interest in language. And what we did back then in natural language processing was very complex parsing, trying to analyze a sentence, trying to map it to semantics, and then produce another sentence from that. It was very brittle and didn't produce good output. And now suddenly, all of a sudden, with those large language models, producing naturally sounding perfect human language is like a solved problem. So language itself is really nearly perfect. But what really needs to be checked and be taken with not just a grain of salt, but really, really carefully, is the truth value behind it. Is it creating something that is a fact? Or is it perhaps, as many people call it, hallucinating? I personally don't like the expression hallucinating so much, because from what I said, you can say ChatGPT is always hallucinating, and very often it just seems to be grounded. It seems to be true, but often it is not. So if you use it in creating a paper, for instance, or a thesis, you need to check every single aspect of it for its veracity. So here's an example. Since I have been working for many years in the field of sleep medicine and data analysis in sleep medicine, I said I tried to imagine what one of my students could use ChatGPT for. I said, try to create three sentences about what is polysomnography, which is the gold standard method in the sleep lab to measure sleep. And the text it created is actually, it's perfect German in that case, and it makes sense and it's true, and it there's no mistake in it, as I would say. But when it comes to the I had to ask it, please include standard references. Here it includes at the end of the text three references. And if I now start to check them, to research them in a literature database to see if they really exist exactly as they are cited here, I find the following. The first one is pretty okay. It exists with exactly this title, but as you can see here from the date, here it's 2017, here 2023, so it's not the newest one is cited, but it's okay. I as a supervisor would leave it that way. I say, okay, the citation is correct. Next one, however, is only partially correct. I can find a paper with that name, but the title is not exactly the same. Here it says ASM scoring manual updates for 2017. Here, the ASM manual for the scoring of sleep. So the authors are correct, but the title is not quite correct. The journal is fine in this case. The third one does not exist at all. This citation here, I know from my personal experience that Dr. Malhotra is a sleep researcher, so he could have written that paper, but he certainly didn't it together with a person called Pierce, certainly not with this title and certainly not in this journal. This is nonsense. So this is just an example to point out. When you generate something with ChatGPT, there's no way but checking every single detail that's in there, especially when it comes to references, but of course also everything that's in the text. So with respect to that, I have some important observations, but of course this is constantly changing. So what I'm saying today might already be old hat 3 months from now, or it might be different. So you have to take that with a grain of salt. But what, again, I am not tired to emphasize that whatever knowledge is created here or replicated or in the text is really only implicitly stored via language. So the fact checking is mandatory, as I just have shown in the example. The knowledge that is contained here is limited time-wise because you have to take into account that this ChatGPT was trained with data up to a certain point in time. It used to be 2022. I think the newest versions go until April 23. But everything that's after that, so asking ChatGPT about what's Trump's reaction to the statement that he's not immune from being prosecuted, it will not know anything about that because that was just in the news today or yesterday. The results are not exactly reproducible. I told you it works with probabilities. So if you input the same prompt twice, the output might be different. That also, on the other hand, makes it hard to detect whether something is computer generated. So, and also you have to take that into account that due to these probabilities, a text might wander off in one direction where you might not want it to go. Error probabilities, so probability to create something that is not factually true, can grow with the length of text. Keep in mind, it generates a text word by word, one after the other. And the longer the text goes away from the original prompt, the more likely it is that, as I called it, it is wandering off in a direction which is not covered by truth anymore. So you saw that in the example, the third citation was much more wrong than was the first citation. So that's important information. Then ChatGPT can create plagiarism. So it can create text which is literally the same as it was in one of the materials. So again, we have to check whether we're not implicitly or unwantingly reproducing the citation of somebody else. So that's, again, something that's important to note. And then something that also I would like to point out and then show an example for is those hallucinations, those errors really depend on how prominent a topic is. So it cannot talk about everything, or it cannot generate text about everything you might think of in the same type of level of veracity. It depends on how much text material was actually there to cover that topic. Just to give an example, again, I used ChatGPT and I said, please explain me what are transformers. So I told you transformers are the neural network type behind ChatGPT. And that's, of course, an area where there's a lot of literature and there's a lot of discussion online. And what it creates is not only, I would say, perfect description of the model. Also, when I asked it to give a few references, it provides those references. And as far as I can tell, all of them are correct. It even provides links to the paper. So this, after check, very little would have to be changed. Now I took the fun and said, okay, what if I ask the same question about a topic that's much, much less known? And I chose something that I used myself. I created that, I invented it, so to speak. That was part of my habilitation back in the 90s. I created a neural network model that I called Koenig Section Function Networks. It was cited a few times. I'm not the only one who published about it. Some groups took it over, but it wasn't like a breathtaking invention, so there's not a huge literature about it. And I asked it, please explain me what are Koenig Section Function Networks, and what it produced here is really, I have to say, utter nonsense. This, it doesn't even translate Koenig Section, which is Kegelschnitt, correctly into German. It all it describes here is pure hallucination. And if I then ask, please give me a few references for that, it even admits itself, I'm sorry, I could not find any specific references. This might be a topic that is not well researched. So again, a warning sign. If you want great text about something that's not very common and not covered by a lot of text material, you even have to be much more careful in fact-checking what it creates. So this all leads us now to how we handle currently, and again, this might change again already next year, the use of such large language models in the creation of master thesis and PhD thesis at the Medical University of Vienna. I was involved in this decision process, even though, I mean, it was mostly developed in the plagiarism check group, which is situated with the library here at the Medical University. So we come to the conclusion together with all curriculum directorates and the rectorate that we do not prohibit generative AI. It is basically permitted, but it must be used in coordination with the supervisor. So never use it without telling anybody, especially not without telling your supervisor. The supervisor is supposed to guide the student in the use. The use of it must then be explicitly indicated and cited in the thesis. It must be said what was done, up to a detail that even it is suggested that the actual prompts that were used are added in the annex of the thesis. So you have to be as transparent as possible how you use the generative model to finally create some of the text that is in your thesis. While doing that, students are enforced to obey data protection rules. So it's absolutely a no-no to upload, for instance, patient data to ChatGPT because we don't know where this data might end up. And also keep in mind, again, the user, in that case, the student is responsible for all content. So everything that is produced must be fact-checked. So in this guideline we are adopting we're very similar to what the World Association of Medical Editors have suggested, not to prohibit the use, but control it or check it or have it under supervision. On top of that, I mean, that's not in our guidelines yet, but that's one of the suggestions I made in the discussion. And I heard Professor Steinacher from the University of Vienna talk about a similar thing a week ago, where they said we can use, I mean, the fact check to check whether the student was doing the proper fact checking. We could perform that by in the thesis defense, we could ask the examiners to pick out randomly a few very detailed aspects of the thesis and ask about the background. Why is this in here? Or can you prove to us that this is really true? So really to have a random check of whether the student fulfilled his or her duty to fact check whatever was generated. So allow me also in the end a few comments, personal comments about the specialness of the field of medicine. I said in the beginning, a lot of things I said are true for all the research fields, but I think in medicine, being more part of science or natural sciences as opposed to the more humanities in the other field, I think here we should not put so much emphasis on the actual prose, the text, because that's, in most cases, in thesis, in medicine, that's secondary. What's important is the data and the results. So actually, we at the Medical University, we want to teach students to perform good clinical studies, a good analysis of the data, and a good presentation of the results. And it's not so much whether they can write in good language or whether they can be very creative in describing something in a new language. So the focus is actually, and I've even said that before ChatGPT, we shouldn't be so focused on plagiarism. What's actually in medicine, what is a much higher risk is fake. If people create data or fake a study, that's, I think, it's a much bigger danger in medicine to the integrity of science than plagiarism is, because plagiarism here is more like how you describe a certain disease in your introductory section. So I think here, and in this context, I think it can only help if students use a large language model to improve the readability of their language, because the facts behind them, they must check anyway, or must be their own from their own studies. So again, I think it's a little less critical, the use than in other fields. But mentioning fakes, of course, we have to keep in mind ChatGPT can also be used to fake study outputs. It's fairly easy to ask ChatGPT, provide me an abstract for a conference, in this case, sleep disorders, write me a good sounding abstract that is likely to be accepted at a conference so I can go there and present my results. ChatGPT, without blinking, so to speak, will create such a fake abstract. But here again, also my personal opinion is that danger of fakes have not increased. I mean, there has always been the danger that scientists make up things that don't exist, are not true data. And therefore, we don't see an additional aspect other than it's very easy these days to create abstracts. And I guess the organizers of conferences nowadays have to be more alert of sorting out potential truly made up abstracts that were only created for the sake of attending that conference. And finally, one thing I've not talked about when it comes to AI in publication is AI performing science itself. That would be a topic worth another full lecture. There was such a lecture a couple of weeks ago here in Vienna. Here, just point, among others, to a publication by the OECD on AI in science. But of course, to round up the topic, that would be an interesting thing to mention as well. But here, I would like to conclude to say I've said that generative AI is a tool for creating publication, but still requires a lot of effort. So it's not necessarily really increasing the efficiency. It's making publications perhaps more readable, and that's good. In this sense, it can only advance science. But true creativity is still a human property, but here also developments are very fast. So look out for more creative systems in the future. And I also tried to point out actually fake data is, in medicine at least, a bigger challenge than artificially created texts, which can, when properly checked, be positive for publications. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Professor Dofner, for this excellent presentation once again. And of course, you're triggering quite a lot of questions, and you're pushing quite some buttons here. I will randomly ask some of the many questions that I have. I think the first question is more now one about the institution, the medical university as such, because the medical university, like any other university in Austria and elsewhere, is at the moment trying to find some rules about this. And you mentioned that there was a committee which was in some way affiliated with the people dealing with plagiarism, if I understood it correctly. And then there were people from the rectorate in this committee, presumably students, I don't know. So who put the people into this committee? Is this something which is permanently working at the moment? And are the meetings public? Is there any outcome of this? Is there any exchange of opinions with other committees working in the domain? And so on.
Well, it hasn't been a formal committee like other committees at the university, like the curriculum commissions and things like that. But the initiative was started by the library, and especially there, the Department for Plagiarism Check, which is located there, and together with the Vice Rector for Education, for Teaching, Anita Rita, they initiated, say, okay, a year before we had published guidelines, or they had published, I shouldn't say we. I was involved as a curriculum director, so I gave my comments. But the actual guidelines were written by that group at the library, and some guidelines were already published a year ago, and it was just realized now with ChatGPT popping up, and they have to be rewritten. And so there was a consensus in the end to decide, okay, we're not going the way of like prohibiting it, but we're allowing it, but we try to put whatever we can, some kind of check mechanism or control mechanism that it would be used properly. Mm-hmm. And we had a presentation to all students in fall, and very likely next fall we'll have another. And this is a published guideline. The first one was still also in print. Now we realized, okay, it will change so quickly. We only have it now as a PDF. It can be downloaded from our homepage. So it's a guideline for all students at the medical university.
And do you have the impression that, so first, is this public? So can everyone download this, or is this only for staff and students of medical university?
Oh, this is public.
This is public. Okay. Are you systematically, or are you aware of anyone who is doing this, systematically evaluating what all the other universities are doing? And are you aware of any group of people who have overview?
I'm aware that pretty much every university is dealing with
this is also my state of knowledge, absolutely.
A systematic review of the activities, I'm not aware of, no.
Isn't that weird? And that triggers another question here, which is the workload of the people dealing with these in all these guidelines. I mean, it's normally those committees are relatively large. They are full with people who have another job to do. And this needs to be updated every 2 or 3 months, as you say. So I don't think that this will scale very well, will it?
I think eventually it will converge within the next year or two. It's like in general, like in other guidelines in publication, you know, the plethora of different citing styles that exists in every field and also within medicine. And then there was something like the Vancouver committee years ago that tried to unify publication, but they didn't succeed either. So every journalist is still cooking their own soup, so to speak, as you use a German expression. And it's similar here. We see it also how the big publishing companies like Springer, Nature and others, Elsevier, are treating it. They're also treating it differently. One say, no, it's absolutely not allowed. The others say, with the proper citation, it is. I think we'll see this variability for another couple of years, and then likely it will converge to that pretty much every university will have similar guidelines.
Yeah, but if this takes several years, I mean, we are educating several generations of medical doctors in those several years. And I mean, as a patient, I would appreciate if there were some kind of common understanding about how this is dealt with, right? Or as a client of a lawyer, by the way, it's not only for medical doctors, it's everywhere the same problem, right? The feeling I have at the moment is everyone is cooking their own soup at the moment. Some of them might be better than others. Some recipes might be better than others, but nobody really compares what's happening, and nobody has any clue about the outcome, obviously. So whether this makes any sense, and it looks very chaotic to me.
I think you're touching your horizon of what you mentioned here is also much wider. Also, the use of AI as a tool in AI in diagnostics, for instance, or something. I mean, that's also, we all know that the AI Act will be out soon from the European Union, but actually the medical field was already before covered a lot by the medical device regulation.
Yes.
And so also here, I mean, the regulatory bodies have been overwhelmed by the speed of the developments and cannot quite keep track of what we might need to have in place as a regulation for the most proper use of AI in the medical process itself, not just creating publications, as I talked about.
Yeah. So let's hope for the best, right? Let's not expect anything, but let's hope for the best. Mm-hmm. Let me ask the question a little bit differently. I mean, you made two very important points, I think, as a side note. The first one was that you said that part of the rules is that people should obey existing laws, in particular data protection. Mm-hmm. And the second side note that I also found very relevant was the remark that you should communicate on this with your supervisor, so that the person reading what the student is doing is aware of what's happening. My assumption would be that both of these requirements are very difficult for the supervisor, because when it comes to the data protection question, you can write a PhD on, or several PhDs on, what exactly is legal and what is not. And when you don't ask only questions about data protection and include, for example, copyright, which is, again, obviously legally binding, and there might be plenty of problems coming with copyright as well. So the supervisor ends up in a situation where a lawyer tells them, better don't touch it, because it's very complicated and it depends very much on every single case. And the communication with the student is very much up to the student, obviously. I mean, there are students who follow these rules and others who don't. And my gut feeling, or actually it's more than a gut feeling, it's also an experience when I talk to supervisors who are not lawyers, is that they feel a little bit alone in the dark when such rules are coming. And my question to you would be, whether you get similar feedback, so that supervisors tell you, what should I do with this now, really, in real life, in practice, if I have a student, for example, who is not really cooperating, or of whom I don't know whether they are cooperating, and what to do with this. So do we need more legal / technical support for the supervisors somewhere centrally organized in the university? Do we need less liability, responsibility for the supervisor being allowed to delegate this somewhere? Or do you think, again, that this will sort out after a chaotic period?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think it's still too early to say. My master's program, ever since the guidelines were published, we only had a small number of finished master's theses. And part of that, our plagiarism check also has a functionality that checks whether it's AI generated or not. We had two cases. One, in my view, was a false positive. The other was a false negative. It was a true positive, and the other was a false positive. In one case, the student admitted they have used without telling. In the other case, the student has signed no. That's certified expert themselves. I don't have much experience yet of how supervisors react to that. I mean, you're absolutely right. We should be careful here not to put the supervisors into a difficult situation that they would have to legally judge anything. I think when it comes to data protection, the example that I raised is fairly easy. It's just something that you might not be aware of, a student might not be aware of, telling them, whatever you use as a prompt, never use any patient identifying information. So don't use ChatGPT to explain a particular medical report of a particular patient or something. So that's, I think, it's fairly easy to handle. The other aspects of data protection, our students have to follow from the very beginning anyways, not to protect the data, and to keep it mostly on university premises and so on. So that's, I think, the other aspect of, like you mentioned, copyright and everything. So I think we will need pragmatic ways of dealing with it. So we will need, but the guidelines are very general and vague. They give the direction. Experience in the next couple of years will show where they work and where they don't, where we have to be more specific. I'm always in favor of being very pragmatic. I'm not the type of guy who likes to work by every word of the law, but to say, okay, let's see what works in practice. We'll have to gather that experience. It's too early to really say how we will be able to treat with all the cases.
And your feedback that you receive from other supervisors or professors and students at the moment is that they can live with the rules as they are at the moment. There is no urgent need to be clearer or to be more specific.
At the moment, apparently, yes, but I'm sure those cases will come where they will raise questions. And as I say, I mean, and that's not explicitly in our guideline yet, but it was especially with respect to our much smaller compared to the medicine curriculum, our small medical informatics curriculum, I'm planning to be more, put little more load also on the supervisors. Say, you might in the past have a course reading of the thesis. Now, please, at least with a random check, try to get in and question, like really go follow a citation and see if it really exists and perform those checks to see how much you can trust the students. I think that will be, it will need some kind of change of how we supervise the writing of the thesis.
Yeah. By the way, I also found very interesting this example that you were showing us with ChatGPT giving an answer in one case that it doesn't have any references, which is one possible answer. The other one could have been a fake reference.
Yeah, right.
And yeah. I don't know when the system is deciding which path to go, right? And that's also, I mean, from a student perspective, this is rather unfortunate, right? Because it
that's connected to the fact that OpenAI is not really telling us everything about how they train.
It's everything but open, right? I mean, there's nothing open there, right? Just the name is open. Everything else is closed. You don't know. You never hear. Which brings me to another question about this fake problem. Because in my view, you are completely right that the problem, in particular in sciences such as medicine, might not be so much that people start copying something coming out of ChatGPT as the introduction to their thesis, but that they will simply start faking the whole experiment. And you said, okay, we will need to be better in rechecking whether the experiment as a whole is realistic. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm asking myself how to do this, because supervisors are quite busy people. Not necessarily they can go into the laboratory and redo an experiment with 300 sleep deprivated patients like the one that you were faking here in this presentation. So how could we do this? Do we then need students to document better than they are, or is it already sufficient what they are doing at the moment? I'm not really completely sure. AI for this in order to identify the problematic cases. So
I think I know exactly what you're referring to, and then I don't have a recipe for that yet either. So I think we're just, I mean, in the past perhaps it was easier to detect that something was made up because it didn't make sense or it was described badly or something, and that might be increasingly be covered by the capabilities of those models to make it look like real. And it just, as I said, it needs a little bit of shift, even if it increases our workload as supervisors will need it. And perhaps then also as examiners at the defense. So I'm thinking about in the future to motivate also the other prüfer, the examiners in a final Diplomprüfung to have at least detailed random checks. And if we apply the pressure to the students and say, if we ever detect even if it's a small detail that you haven't been transparent or you haven't been truthful, then you risk that the whole master thesis is thrown back. And then under that type of check, I think they will be hopefully motivated to be as honest as possible. So the role of supervisors will have to change a bit. And then we'll have to go more into some of the details than previously.
Yeah, and that brings me to another question, which is obviously whatever the role of a supervisor might look like in 3 or 5 years, that has a significant impact on how students perceive their workload and how they need to optimize their own work. My impression of the situation at the moment is that students don't have a clue either how all this has an impact on what they are expected to do and what they are going to do. How to bring them into the game? I mean, students are, at least in many cases, not really very good in organizing their own interests for many reasons, one of them being that they don't have a job, right? They are at the university, they are students there. Different from you or me, right? We get at least paid from this institution. They don't, right? So how to bring them? So two questions here. First one, do you think that they are properly represented at the moment in these debates? So is it working as it is at the moment? And second question, how to keep them in this process?
Well, that's, I mean, as in every formal committee at the university, according to law, the student representatives always have
Yeah, that's a very formalistic answer, right? Because normally we are, I mean, you know, and I know
I was just saying, as I said, this committee that put together these guidelines was not a formal committee, but students were involved in here too. So far, what I have seen from student representatives, they are certainly on the understanding side and said that something will need to be done. I mean, we just have to raise awareness that, I don't know, this again sounds very idealistic, that it's for their own, it's for everybody's own good that you learn what we're trying to teach them. And cheating or faking hurts in the end always yourself. And so, I mean, you're supposed, a diploma, a master thesis or a PhD thesis is a way of showing that you have learned, apply some, at least some scientific principles to some questions in medicine, and that's what we give you the degree for. And any step to sidestep that and getting that without having done the work behind it. I got my PhD in the US, and then I was surprised when I was a student on campus there, in that case it was Indiana University, to hear that there's something like open book tests. Students were sent home and said they're allowed to use this and that book, and no other things allowed, and they have to add to do the exam. And most people obeyed to this rule. I mean, I thought back then in Austria this would never work. This is like an invitation to cheating. But the awareness was such that it's really, you're a student, you're there at an honorable quote unquote institution, you're there to learn, to get something out of it, and it's not in your own interest, let alone that you might be fired from the school, kicked out if something was discovered that you were cheating. And I think that might be the kind of way to go forward, to raise more that awareness among the students. And I'm pretty sure that student representatives are fully in support of such a. So I'm a pragmatist. I'm not favoring penalties and punishing and guidelines and rules, but more for arguing for creating more the awareness of what it actually is about to get your degree from the university. I might be too idealistic here, but
I don't know. I mean, I think it very much depends on culture, on academic culture, which is probably very different in Austria than in the US, as you rightly mentioned. That was already the case 30 years ago, and I think it still is. I mean, cheating is very differently seen in the US and in Austria as a whole. And then it also very much depends on the specific studies. And perhaps in medicine, the situation is better than in law, for example, because I assume that you are very, very picky when selecting the students, but there is relatively less pressure than on students during the curriculum than there is, for example, in law studies, where people are really, there's a lot of pressure in this curriculum, and that might also have an impact, right? But I was not so much about the cheating part, which is obviously also important. I was more about the competences part, right? So what exactly do students expect us to tell them that they should know when being examined about something which has an AI impact, right, or implication? And that's obviously also part of all these guidelines written at the moment, because what one of the things always said there, also in yours, is we don't prohibit this, we want students to learn on that, but it's much less clear than what exactly they should learn apart from writing a proper prompt, right? and learning this possibly faster than their professors, because they are younger. And so I think this needs a lot of thought also from the students' perspective. And that was the point that I wanted to make, that not necessarily students are always properly represented in this exercise, how the ideal teaching experience and examining experience should look like in future. That was my point. Not so much the cheating, but the cheating, of course, is also important, obviously. Yeah. Let me perhaps ask one very last question, if I may, Professor Dorfner, which is, I mean, remarkably, you wrote your habilitation, so your postdoc big book in 1994 in the field of AI, if I'm not mistaken, right? So it's 30 years now. And after 30 years of academic work in AI, I would assume, and I think you mentioned this also, your daily work has significantly changed in the last year or two. And my question to you now is whether you think that we have enough knowledge at the universities coming from people like you, 30 years of experience in the field, that will help us in properly or better steering what's happening here, or whether we would, as a step zero before starting with anything else, would need at the moment to urgently educate the educators first, because people like you are very, very, I mean, there is a very small number of people like you at an average university at the moment. So wouldn't that be the first thing to do? Let's send every professor into a 6-month intensive course taught by people like you, and then let's start with the debate.
That's a difficult question. I mean, education is certainly something that is needed. It's I mean, I have to say, I mean, having followed this field for more than 30 years now, I mean, the last 4 or 5 years, I felt myself like I was almost run over by a train. I mean, I was like walking down the tracks, and suddenly this high speed train came by, and I didn't for a moment know what was going on and whether I'm still on the right track or not. So this describes how quick and fast the developments have been. And what I see, and that comes a little bit back to what you're saying, is that some of the new machine learners that are now creating those high impact scientific publications seem to have thrown overboard some of the principles that we have learned over the years together. I mean, neural networks in the 1980s, when they were introduced, years later, statisticians came and said, hey, what you're doing actually is statistics, but you're doing it in a bad way because you don't know the theory and you're not applying the methods correctly. So I learned and tried to convey that to my students for many years, how important it is to know some statistical theory behind, like how many degrees of freedom can you have if you have so much data and so on. And some of these principles seem to be thrown overboard nowadays in the deep learning era. And I think here I wouldn't say that they're doing it wrong this way. So perhaps really those principles are no longer applicable. That might be things, but we need to be aware of that and need to, I think here's some education of looking back, how did we do machine learning in a statistically principled way some years ago, what we're doing now, should we perhaps doing when it comes to things, important things like transparency, bias, correct output and so on, versus uncertainty. I mean, we have preached for many years, every machine learning model should also be able to say something about its own uncertainty. So there are principled ways of dealing with this more that some of the deep learners don't seem to know about or don't seem to apply. So here, yes, I think I don't want to put myself in the position as if I'm the wise man because I've done this for so many years. So, but some kind of at least comparison of what we learned previously and what we could still learn with those new methods that have risen and come about so quickly and fast is certainly necessary. On the other hand, yes, I think every university, including ours, Medical University of Vienna, is doing the best to get good scientists at the top. So we also recently have announced a few more professorships, filled some of the positions already with really known researchers in the field. So I think we are prepared, or the universities are ready to get prepared. But yeah, educating the educator is, I guess, an important thing that we should think about.
Okay, so then let's think about this. Thank you so much for the moment, for contributing to this debate and by giving us so many different aspects and food for thought on this debate. Thank you. Thank you all to all of you who listen to us. I hope that we stay in touch. I hope that you stay interested. And in particular, I do hope that all of us stay healthy or become as healthy as possible, as quickly as possible. Take care and all the best. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you from my side too.